Hello, and welcome to DCG Garage, Episode 3. This episode features Steve Prieg. I've known Steve for years, and he and I have worked on several projects over the last decade. He also happens to be a member of the Digital Human League. He has a pretty interesting past, which we get into, including some legal animation that he did for some big trials, which is something I never knew about him. And he also has a huge roster of films that he's worked on, things like Final Fantasy, Lord of the Rings, King Kongs. He also has worked on Benjamin Buttons, which he happened to have won an Oscar for, Tron Legacy, which I work with him on as well. And he also did the digital Tupac hologram that was at Coachella a couple of years ago. That was part of his body of work as well. We talk about the Uncanny Valley for a little bit and what people think and how people think about it. Pretty interesting discussion, as well as the fact that once you start to get very good at doing digital humans and you start to cut out of the valley, you may have a sort of a moral responsibility of the types of work that you do. And we have that discussion about the moral responsibility of digital artists and that level. So I thought that was a really interesting discussion to have. So we plan to do more of these. Let us know what you think. Leave your comments and hopefully you'll enjoy it.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
I don't know how far back you want to go, but you want to talk about Los Alamos?
Like in the 40s? Like that far back?
You're not that old, dude.
No, I'm not. I started, I went to UC Santa Barbara and got a mechanical engineering degree and was working. I grew up in Los Alamos, so I ended up going back to the laboratory there. And doing some work there in a explosives machining group.
So bombs and stuff?
Well, maybe parts of bombs, but it was pretty interesting, just instead of cutting things like metal or plastics or whatever, you're cutting high explosives.
Right. That's got to be a little bit stressful.
Yeah, I didn't do the actual cutting itself. I was kind of working on things that were safety mechanisms and things for when they were going to cut it. But even the people that were doing the machining, you sort of set up all your tool paths and run tests on wax and make sure everything's working. And then when you're actually cutting the machine, the explosives, you're sitting behind a quite thick concrete steel reinforced wall with the third wall is a blowout wall. In case something goes wrong, it'll just all go out the opposite direction and it's all remotely run. So
okay.
I don't think there's ever actually been an accident in that area over there. So with all the rules and standards and everything that OSHA puts on that place, it's probably safer to work there than at DD.
Well, I mean, were you doing 3D work there, or is that how you started on 3D? Or
well, it was mostly 2D stuff. I mean, we were using AutoCAD.
Oh, okay.
The smaller design stuff was using AutoCAD. They were using some beefier tools for doing the main design work that they do there. I think they've switched recently because, that was way back. So I think the software has been upgraded quite a bit since then. And I was pushing at the time to actually try and get some visualization tools going there, like, taking the stuff out of AutoCAD and getting into 3D Studio Max. And, they didn't really necessarily want to do that. I don't know if it was just because, it's like, this is the way we do things and we don't want to change or whatever. And then a few years later, my brother-in-law, who was still working there, called me up because he had heard me talking about it. He worked in a group that was nearby, and their group happened to have a little bit more money than my group did. So I'd always run over there and say, hey, we should, get some money out of your group and do this.
Right.
And so he called me a few years later and he says, I kind of took this idea that you had back then and I pitched it to him. And, I don't remember how much they gave him, but it was a decent chunk of money. And he's like, but now I don't, what do I do? Like, what kind of machines? What software do I get? Where do I go?
Right.
And so for a little while, every so often, I'd go back there and do some consulting and go work with their that hired a few 3D artists on there, and I'd go work with them for a few days a year and just, you know, talk about how to make their process better. And,
right.
But it was pretty successful, I think, that effort that they set up there.
So was it, I mean, is that where you started doing 3D work, or where did you start really doing 3D work?
Well, I started, I mean, I had some friends in college that were in the, you know, film and art school. Mm-hmm. And I got asked at one point by a friend of mine there was a land usage case up in the Santa Barbara area of some people that wanted to build a house, and all the neighbors were essentially against them building this house there, claiming that it was going to be an eyesore, too big, or block the view of so-and-so, or, you know, and it was up in Montecito, and it was, you know, it was gonna be a multi-million dollar home. And, you know, the people around there was like, they were pretty wealthy people as well. And, so we were asked by this family to, you know, basically take the map of the lot and the blueprints of their house and basically build their house. And so this friend of mine got approached, and he asked me to help him out. And, cause you know, we'd been kind of working in 3D studio and AutoCAD together, even though he was in the more film art side and I was in the engineering side of things. And, so
you were almost doing ArcViz at that point, kind of.
Yeah. I mean, it was more of just initially kind of to help, you know, I was like, what do I do with these pictures that are all in, you know, orthographic views?
Right.
And I was like, all right, well, so, you know, we built this whole thing up, and it turned out that, you know, we were working for this family, and then the whole housing community, they had their own visualization group that was, you know, doing something to refute what we were working on. And it was just me and this other dude, you know, like doing this kind of on our own. And it turned out it was Santa Barbara Studios that was doing the stuff for the other side. And I think in the end, it turned out that these people, the community didn't want those people there, not because the house was going to be an eyesore or anything, but because these people were frankly just assholes.
Really?
You know, I didn't know it at the time. I learned later, quite directly and so on that was the case, but
right.
We ended up, they ended up winning the case and they were able to build their house. And
wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So legal stuff, legal ArcViz.
Yeah. Way. And I actually worked, very briefly on the OJ Simpson trial as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool history.
I guess. Except we were working for the defense.
Oh, really? So it's your fault. Your visualization was too good.
Well, no, it's funny because, you know, when we did it, like they wanted to take some aerial footage of the neighborhoods and then basically put in, you know, this little CG guy running and then have like a little readout of like how many miles an hour he would have to go and what route he would take to get.
So go from one place.
From one place to the other, yeah. And like do all this stuff. And I was like, okay. So we took their plates and we put this guy in and, you know, put all the stuff in there and rendered it out and sent it to the defense. And they're like, but you made the guy black. And I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, right. And they said, well, you can't make him black. Cause then they're going to make, it's going to look like it's OJ.
Right.
And I'm like, well, do you want us to make him white? Like yeah. that's
misleading.
Isn't that going to be weird or whatever? And they're like, well, no, you can't make him white. And I'm like, all right.
What would you like me to make him
so
green?
So it ended up he was kind of an ultimate blue.
Okay.
So, yeah. A little blue OJ running around, but.
Or blue murderer who was not OJ.
Of course, yeah. Guy. Right. Oops. Trial's over.
That's know. Right. Yeah.
I don't know. So I don't even, I mean, I wasn't really in, you know, in court or anything, so I don't know. You know, to make myself sleep better at night, I assume that it didn't have any impact on any of the
sure
any of it.
So what do you think? I mean, so what got you into feature films then?
So the same guy that I had done this project for with the house use land usage case, he ended up interning at Lightstorm Entertainment.
Okay.
And they started doing some pre-production stuff on films where they're doing monitor graphics and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me if I wanted to do that. And I mean, even though engineering was interesting, it was, you know, it didn't sound as fun. Let's just put it that way, I guess.
Sure.
But, you know, it's kind of one of those things where you feel like in engineering, if you do something wrong, you know, then maybe a bunch of people die. Whereas in visual effects, if you do something wrong, people just kind of bash it on, you know, right. Ain't It Cool News or something, which they're going to do anyway. So
right.
No one gets hurt really except for your feelings.
Okay.
So, unless it's in.
So you just went to feature film so you would be allowed to make mistakes?
Yeah. Without so many consequences.
Without so many, okay.
No, but there was a lot of red tape in engineering. And you know, yeah. Almost like something like 80% of mechanical engineers work for the defense industry in some way or another. And,
right.
You know, even though you have all these dreams of like, you know, I'm going to design the next Lamborghini or whatever. And then it's like, no, you're going to design the latch on the, you know, on the glove box on the next, you know, Ford Escort.
Right.
That's what you're really going to do. And I was like, oh, that's less appealing.
Right.
So it just sounded kind of more fun to, and my friend at the time was like, and there's tons of money in the movie industry. And, you know, at the time it was kind of true, but.
So that, how did that lead you to Square?
Well, Square was years later. I mean, I worked for I was living at the time I had moved back to Santa Barbara. I was living in Santa Barbara at the time, but working down here in LA. And that commute got old, and my wife was pregnant at the time with our second kid, and her family was up in the Bay Area. So we decided to move up to the Bay Area. So I ended up taking a job at this small studio called Metropolis Digital, which was mostly doing commercials and video game work and different stuff like that, a little bit of feature stuff here and there. And I was there for a handful of years, 3 or 4 years. And a friend of mine up there, we were big into watching anime and you know, some of that stuff. And he worked at the same place, but he ended up leaving. He got unhappy there and left. And it turns out this guy named Koyokiyama was one of the guys that we had really appreciated his design work that he had done. And he was, I think it was him. There's two different designers, and I don't remember which one. Anyway, basically, he went and interviewed at Square because he caught wind of it from somewhere. He was looking for a job, mm-hmm. and he called me. He's like, "Dude, this guy's working down here. Like, you got to come down here." And so I figured I would, you know, apply and go check it out at least. And I said, "Well, you know, what would be a good thing to get together, you know, for a demo reel to show them?" And
what year was this about?
This was probably, I don't know, maybe 96,
okay,
something like that. We had both been big fans of Evangelion, you know, the Japanese anime, and, mm-hmm. you know, where it was at the point where, like, literally I would run out the day the next episode was released in the U.S., you know, I'd run to the store and buy the VHS tape of it, which, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of dates it right there, I guess.
Yeah.
And we'd go over to his place and watch it, And so I'd started as just a modeling test when it was like a new version of Alias, mm-hmm. Power Animator had come out, and there were some new modeling tools I wanted to play with. So I was looking around in my desk at something to try modeling, and I had a little, you know, model of Evangelion toy. So I started modeling that, and I ended up building a pretty detailed model of Evangelion thing. And so it's like, oh, well, the guy down here that you'd be interviewing with, you know, he's got a big Evangelion, you know, EVA 01 on his desk. He's like, you should, you know, do something with that.
Yeah.
And so I took the model, and there was a really good animator that I worked with. His name was Louis Lefebvre. I don't say it right because it's French, and my pronunciation skills are kind of bad in that way. But he's a really good animator, and so I asked him kind of if he would do some animation on that test.
Yeah.
And we didn't really have a lot of time to get it done, and we didn't have a lot of resources. So rather than build like this whole city and have this guy destroying a city, I decided we'd make it where, since it was a model that I modeled, like, let's just make it a model. And so he was just a little, like, you know, 8-inch model,
right,
propped up on a little stick on somebody's desk. And then we made this little cockroach run by, and, you know, Louis animated this little cockroach, and then the toy kind of comes to life and checks it out and jumps down and shoots the cockroach.
So you almost just basically made something for your reel specifically for that job.
Not even just sort of.
You just
did that. Yeah, it was like, well, I'd already started modeling it. And
right.
At the time, we were beta testing Maya.
Yeah, that wasn't even out by then.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, so it was just Alias, really.
Yeah, so I was working in Alias. Maya was in beta. We were beta testing Maya. And so the modeling was done in Power Animator, but I had done the rigging and all that stuff in Maya. And so we did did that and sent it down. And you know, Square was working in the beta of Maya. They, that's what their whole thing had been set up in. So, you know, going down there to interview, not only had I done this thing that was just kind of right for the guy that was interviewing me, but it was also in Maya, which, you know, very few people at the time were using. So it was kind of a good, and then in fact, the animator that animated it was like, you know, if you're interested in going down there, like, I want to check it out. So we actually went and flew down out to Hawaii and interviewed on the same day.
Yeah, because at the time, the Square was in Hawaii at that time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole project was done in Hawaii. And so we flew out there on the same day. And yeah, and both got a job and started in the same day. And
that's cool. So how long were you in Hawaii for?
Almost 4 years, I think.
Wow.
We did the Final Fantasy project. I got there. They had a test project that ended up being called the Gray Project, which was their first sort of attempt at one of the scenes on Final Fantasy. And that had just finished up when I got down there, and we had just started actual production on what was actually in the film, which at the time was actually being rendered in Maya, in the Maya render. That was the whole plan, was to render in Maya. And then, after a little while, when we started having some issues with, you know, some of the issues that the Maya renderer had, or maybe even still has, I don't know. I haven't rendered Maya in a long time, but they ended up deciding to switch to RenderMan. But there is still one scene in the movie that was finished by that point, and it's still a Maya renderer.
Maya render.
Yeah.
So what was your role on
Final Fantasy?
Yeah.
I was... man, I have to watch the credits, but it's something like I was in the sets and props department.
Okay.
And it was something like sets and props assistant supervisor or something. I don't remember what the title was, but basically, what I ended up, what I was actually doing was mostly working with pipeline and rigging and getting the sets and props, you know, into a fashion that was, something that could be passed through the pipeline.
Okay.
We ended up, there was, Kevin Oakes was kind of, he's at DreamWorks now, but he was kind of the guy that was doing a similar thing over in the character department, and another Japanese guy, I forget his name, but so we worked pretty closely together.
So were you doing character work then, or?
There was a little bit of crossover, but not a ton. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of sets and props on that show.
Right.
And even just managing how to get all that through the pipeline and all that stuff. I ended up, once the sets and props kind of wrapped up, I moved into what they called kind of a sequence supervisor role, which was then working more with the lighting and compositing side to get shots through at that point. And myself and a guy named Dave Seeger, who I think he's up at MPC in Vancouver now, we ended up being, when we finished Final Fantasy, you know, of course there was this thinking that was like, this thing's going to make $1 trillion and we're going to make the next 16 sequels there. And at the same time, we're going to be making other films and we're going to all be rich and it's going to be awesome. And so they had this idea, like, we got to, you know, modify the pipeline to be able to handle multiple movies at the same time and, you know, figure out what we learned from the old pipeline and, you know, change it and whatever you need to do, even if you need to scrap the entire thing, go ahead and do it. And so Dave Seeger and I, they used to call us Prieger there. We were sort of the two guys from the sort of 3D production side that were working on it. And then we had Troy Brooks was kind of the system side guy, and Kevin Bjorky, who was a long time. I mean, that guy's just a render man genius. He was sort of the render side guru. So the four of us were kind of tasked with coming up with the new pipeline. And so that pipeline was put into place for what we did, the Animatrix short.
Right.
By the time the Animatrix short finished is essentially when Square shut down in Hawaii, because the movie hadn't done that well and we hadn't gotten any other work. So that's when we all kind of split up.
That's when you first met Andy Jones as well, or?
Well, I first met Andy, he was on Final Fantasy. So he came in, I don't know, I'd probably been at Square for 8 months or 10 months or a year or something like that before he came in. He came in a little bit later after the Gray Project was done. There was a different animation supervisor on the show initially, and then Andy took over So I worked with Andy during that. And then, of course, he directed the Animatrix short.
Right.
And so I worked closely with him on that. And which is very similar to the pipeline that you ended up working with on iRobot when
Right. Well, I was going to say that because, you know, basically the first time I worked with you was on iRobot. So that's already a long time ago. But it was you and Andy. I remember you guys were very close and you guys had a very specific idea about how the process was going to go and what we were going to work. And I really liked it. I know that the iRobot pipeline was different at DD. It was like one of the first big transition ones that they did.
Yeah, it was a big, yeah.
Yeah.
There was a lot of yelling and stuff.
But it worked. It worked really well. I mean, the thing is, I liked it. I mean, I still think of iRobot as one of the most fun shows we worked on. But it did take a while for the pipeline to get solidified. I remember we went through way longer than we should have to start finaling shots. I mean, these days people, they would go crazy over it. But and once we did, they were just coming out left and right. And we could relight things. Everything was versionless, which was really kind of a new concept for me. But worked really, you could light six shots in like no time.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, you know, that was, Andy kind of tricked me on that one, you know, because I was down at Weta at the time. You know, I was working on the Lord of the Rings movies.
Oh, right. That's right. 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 Yeah. So you, after Square, you went to Weta?
I went to Weta from Square. And we were just wrapping up, you know, I probably had a few months left on the last Lord of the Rings movie when Andy contacted me about working at DD.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was telling me like, you know, because he knows I was kind of a geek or am. And so he's like, you know, iRobot. You know, I'd read, you know, Cave of Steel and I'd read iRobot and I'd read all that stuff. And he's like, it's going to be awesome. You know, Patrick Tatopoulos is doing the design, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, you got to check this out. You got to come be part of this. It's going to be great. You know, and you can be rigging these robots and they're going to be great. And I'm like, you know, all right, well, iRobot's wrapping up. You know, by that point, my wife and I had split up. My kids were in the U.S. And so I was like, you know, I got to probably be closer than 6,000 miles from my kids when they're, you know.
So I came back. Lord of the Rings was wrapping up.
And So I came out to DD and I go into work the first day and I'm like, all right, Andy, let's see the designs. You know, and he's like, well, first, we need to make DD run like Square. And I'm like, what?
Before you do that, we're going
to
change
it. Before you did to do anything fun. And so, you know, I was like, well, I don't know how DD works at all. Like, I'd never worked there and I didn't know anything about it. And I mean, frankly, back then, DD's, you know, it was pretty wild, wild west back then. It was you know, where's the latest version of that? And it's like, oh, I think it's in Joe's user directory. Grab it from there.
Yeah.
You know? And we'll send email when it's ready and whatever.
Yep.
And so, you know, Andy really wanted a lot of stuff that we had worked on at Square to kind of be implemented in. And I was like, look, I'm, you know, happy to write this whole thing up and everything or and whatever. But, you know, I'd be shocked if DD's willing to change their entire core structure, you know, based around what I have to say. I mean, they don't know who I am.
Right.
But Andy had a lot of push there, pull, clout, whatever. And so, you know, I wrote up this proposal, like, you know, the first week I was there, they're like, don't go to training or learn anything about the current job system because you're going to change it anyway. So just write up a proposal. And I'm like, okay. Right. So I wrote up a proposal and actually Darren Hendler was there at the time and he had been there a while. And they're like, if you have any questions, you can ask Darren. And so, you know, I talked to Darren about it and he had read through it and I was like, you know, what do you think? And he's like, well, I think it's really cool, but, you know, there's no way they're going to go for it. I mean, this is a huge change. And I'm like, that's what I'm thinking, you know? Yeah. And so they said, oh, go present it. So I presented it. And, you know, like next day, it's like, all right, that's what we're doing. I'm like, really?
Yeah.
Like, really? Yeah. You really want to do that? So, we went down that road and there was, you know, some rough roads that were part of that, you know, when it didn't happen overnight.
Right.
It wasn't going. I mean, there's a ton of tools.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the rough patches, but, you know, there's a pipeline.
Yeah.
Every pipeline.
But there was, not only was it versionless, but it was also relative paths, which
right.
Square and that show at DD are the only times that I've worked with relative paths, which were really, really pretty useful in a lot of cases. You know, John Hewitt, for example, he was lighting the interrogation scene of Sonny. Yeah,
I remember.
And, you know, they asked him to do a first pass of like every shot in that scene. It was like he lit the room because Sonny didn't really move. He was sitting in a chair the whole time.
Right.
you know, they said, well, you should be able to set up a lighting rig and then basically run over the weekend, run like every shot. First, you know, come Monday, we'll have a version we'll be able to see. So they called me and said, hey, can you help John, you know, set up a scene for every shot so that he can kick off every shot?
But you didn't need to do that.
And I was like, sure. And I walked over to John's and he's like, what do I need to do? And I'm like, nothing, you're done. Yeah. Like, you can take your one shot, whatever shot you've actually lit.
Just open it
in any shot and it'll update the anim, it'll update everything that you need will be, you know, set up. So all you need to do is take one file and just submit it under all the different shots. And
yeah, it was pretty amazing because you just exactly like you said. I mean, you did what you had your shot, you had your scene file, and you just literally opened it up in another shot directory, and it would just bring in whatever assets you already had, bring in the animation that's relative to that shot, the camera to that shot, and then you're just done. So all you have to do is just open up the scene file in another shot and you could just hit go. Or not even do that. You could basically script it out and just write out every shot. So it was really kind of – it was kind of cool to do that. I think one of my favorite memories of working on iRobot was I was one of the lighting sequence soups on it, and I've been working on the scene in the office of the
police station.
No, not the police station. I did the police station stuff too, but it was the Robinson's office.
Oh, okay.
And where Sonny was holding the gun to the girl, and I think I decided I was going to light it myself, and then I think Jessica, and no, who was the comper on it? Oh, she was such a good comper. She was the comper. She had worked at Boss Films. Deborah.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Anyway, so I'd lit the shot, and it's a very painful scene. He's got the gun to her head. It's very emotional. And like at the end, the Sonny gives that wink, which was part of the movie. And then Andy just came up. We've been running the shot for a long time, and everyone's scrutinizing over details, the eye glints, and everything like that. And Andy just comes up to me and he's like, because he had been animating himself. He said, just – when you rendered a shot this weekend, just add another 80 frames to the end of the shot. And I said, okay, what? Can I do that? It's like, yeah, just add another 80. Just keep rendering another extra 80 frames. And so I did. And so right after he gives a wink, and then he blows a kiss to Will Smith, which was awesome. And so I forgot who was our editor on the, but he basically made the edit with the kiss in there, and it just looks like Will Smith goes crazy or starts shooting up everyone because he's freaked out about this crazy robot.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was really, and we actually showed it to a director who thought it was really funny as well. it was such a good show. I saw Andy earlier this year. I went to Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn.
Yeah, yep.
And he was there, and we were talking about that show. It was so much fun. So you were doing a lot of the rigging at the time, I remember. That was your main responsibility was rigging.
Yep.
Is that sort of one of the first shows where you were heavily involved in character work?
In Weta? Well, Weta was
Weta pretty, as well. Okay.
Pretty heavy character work, yeah.
Right.
I had just come off of I got there early on film 2 of Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And by film 3, or really down there at the time, it was actually the extended edition of film 2. Mm-hmm. The Gollum rig had been dumped in my lap, and so I spent most of the after part of film 2 and film 3 working on Gollum.
Right.
On film 2, that had been a mishmash of creatures, and you know, the wargs and the Ents and I don't remember even all the different characters at the time, but
right.
I know at least the Ents and the Wargs and the. I did some work on the wings for the Nazgul, the flying creatures.
Okay.
That was a good, you know, that was a good couple projects.
Right.
And I had done some character work at Metropolis, which was it was a small company, so it's pretty much nothing you've probably ever seen.
Right.
And if you did, you'd cancel the whole podcast and go, this guy doesn't deserve to be in that
well
chair.
I mean, I think we've already established that that some of the stuff you've done has been known. So and then you went back to Weta for a little bit to work on King Kong, right?
Yeah. After iRobot, the next project that had been lined up at DD, there was talk already actually at that point. There was a brief like teasing of Benjamin Button coming in.
I remember because we were, I think I was working on Stealth and there was that first test that was done.
Yeah. So even before that test was done is when I left. And so basically Darren Grant had said, you know, there's this Benjamin Button thing coming up, you know, that might be really cool. And I was like, all right, when's that going to happen? He's like, well, it's a little ways out. So in the meantime, you know, there's this movie Stealth. Okay. And I'm like, what's that about? And it's like, well, it's about an airplane that gets struck by lightning and becomes sentient. I'm like, I'm out. Yeah. You know? I don't know about that.
Yeah.
So, well, yeah, I don't want to go into too many stories about that. But anyway, so I was kind of like, well, you know, I don't really want to work on an airplane, a talking airplane movie. And so, and my friends back at Weta had said, you know, the art and the, you know, everything that was going into King Kong, like it was going to be this massive show and lots of cool creatures to work on and stuff. And so I decided to head back down there. And so I was on Kong. I did a little bit of work on a test for Tintin, but at the time, Tintin was going to be a live act, or at least a test was a live action test. And just the dog was CG Snowy. And so I did some work on Snowy.
Oh, I didn't realize that Tintin was live action to start with.
I don't know if the plan was really to make a live action film or not. I mean, you know, it's just kind of like, here's a plate and, you know, make a dog. I was like, okay. I mean, don't ask too many questions, I guess. I guess it could have asked, but it was my understanding that it was, the intent was that it was going to be live action and then Snowy was going to be CG. And so we did that test and I guess in the long run, they decided it was going to be all CG, or maybe it was already decided. I don't know.
And then did you come back to DD after that to work on Buttons or?
No, well, Buttons still.
Buttons, so, it took a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when I finished Kong, that was another situation where, you know, I kind of talked to my kids about, hey, they want to come to New Zealand or whatever. And they're like, they wanted to stay back in the States. And they're like, you need to come back. And so, you know, I think there was probably some pretty good work lined up at Weta still. But I was like, you know, it's kind of like living in a hotel, you know, for a long period of time. Like I went down to the first time I went down to New Zealand, I had, you know, these ideas of, you know, bring all my stuff and move in and become a Kiwi or whatever. And because my wife and I split up, I figured, well, I should come back and take care of this whole thing and, you know, get that all straightened out, which is why I went to DD in the first place. So the second time I went down, I was like, you know, I'm going to be smarter this time. I'm just going to go down with two suitcases and rent a furnished apartment. And then I don't have to worry about all that stuff. But then, of course, it makes it feel like you're living out of a hotel room for a year and a half. And so it didn't take a whole lot of, you know, of my kids saying they want me to come back to the States. And I was like, yeah, probably should. And so I thought, well, you know, the easier choice was DD because I'd worked there before. I knew people and they were just like, yeah, come on back.
Right.
And I was also talking to Sony at the time. And that was, I think they were just ramping up for Beowulf.
Right.
And so that's what I was talking to them about. And I ended up choosing DD because it was I went back to DD for Flags of Our Fathers just because, you know, it's a pretty cool movie to work on.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a
lowbrow. Yeah, and I heard Eastwood was just an awesome, awesome director.
Yeah, you know, and it's just it was a cool idea. It was a cool, you know, it was something different. It wasn't going to be a, I don't know. I thought it would be a drama that wouldn't just be a big CG fest and everything.
Right.
And so I came back to work on that, which obviously also rolled into, you know, I guess like Letters from Iwo Jima was what it ended up being called. But I think at the time it was Black Sand, Red Blood or something. I don't remember the title at the time, but
yeah, the Japanese,
the Japanese version of it. So that was what I came back for. And my intention was really just to use that as a way to get, you know, back into the States and then kind of look around and decide what I wanted to do. So after Flags, you know, I did a little bit of work on, I don't remember which Transformers it was, and a little bit of stuff on Pirates while we were, you know, looking for other stuff for me to work on. And I'd actually been talking to a couple other companies and the main company I was talking to was actually Leica. I was very, very close to going up to Leica. And at the time, they were still working on doing these fully CG non-stop motion movie. There was one, something about a couple birds. I don't remember the name of it.
Okay.
So I went up there, talked to the director, talked with all the people up there. And, you know, I was really close to accepting that job. We'd agreed on kind of everything. And that was right when DD got bought out. and there was a kind of this big shift happening at DD. Oh, and right. I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. Like, I wonder what's going to happen here, you know?
Yeah, that was DD 2.0, I guess, at the time.
I guess I lost track of the numbers.
So that was when John
1.93 Texter. 1.93 beta 2.
Wincrest bought
DD. Yeah. Yeah. And they brought in, you know, like Kim LeBrary and right. Cliff. And
And Speed Racer started.
And Speed Racer started, yeah. And so not only did that happen, but that was like right around the time when Button was starting to heat up. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of like, well, you know, Leica does sound interesting, but I'm already at DD and this whole shakeup could be actually really interesting. So mm-hmm. I was like, maybe I should see how this plays out a little bit first. And so I decided to stay at DD and pretty much my next project, other than, you know, the Orville Redenbacher thing, which was the practiced version of Benjamin Button.
Right.
Which in some ways was intentionally the practice version.
So obviously when you went on to Buttons, and obviously the success of Buttons is really big, and we'll get into that one, but there was so much difference between Redenbacher and Buttons.
Yeah.
So that must have been a really big, I mean, you must have learned a lot from Redenbacher in order to get right. to Buttons, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I mean, that's what I'm saying. It was kind of the intention, right? Because David directed the Redenbacher spot.
Yeah, which is
knowing that his next film was Button.
But what's amazing to me is that someone like David is like, oh, screw it. We can never do it. So look at what it's going to look like. You know, it's almost like he was reassured that there was, let's just call it a failure in a way, in terms of looking like a
Redenbacher, you mean?
Yeah. In a way, it definitely had a very Uncanny Valley effect on sure. it, which Buttons did not. So he somehow still trusted the system that, okay, we've learned that. So now where do we go from here?
Right. And that was kind of the mandate from David on the Orville spot, was like, try everything.
Right.
You know, it was like, figure out how you're going to do Button by trying everything. So yep. in some ways, Orville was a bit of a Frankenstein of literally just, I mean, I'm not saying that we tried to flub that thing up.
No,
I mean, we're trying to make it look as good as we could.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a lot of technology at the time that, you know, Mova, for example, was brand new. In fact, we tried using Mova on Orville.
Right.
And they were literally just not ready to deliver data. So even though we did a Mova session with it, mm-hmm. We never got any data for Orville.
Right.
And that was, you know, one of the things that we were trying. And I think it would have helped. And then, so the other thing that was relatively new at the time that we were trying was Face Robot.
Oh, right. The soft image thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was a combination of trying a whole bunch of different things and not only the learning process on that side, but the learning process on the live action shoot. You know, it's like, what is really important when you're actually shooting the plates to make this work well, you know?
Right.
And I think, you know, I don't necessarily want to say David learned anything, because he's a pretty smart guy. And so he may have already known, but,
right.
you know, my guess is that he learned some stuff too on how he was actually going to shoot stuff.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, I think we all kind of took away a lot of information from Orville. And now that's not to say that when we rolled on the Button, you know, right. that I wasn't terrified.
Yeah.
I mean, literally that was, I used to call my brother and be like, John, I think I gotta quit. Like, I don't know how this is going to happen. Like, you know, this is terrifying.
Well, you know what's, I mean, I still consider it, because I wasn't at DD at the time, but I obviously still a lot of connections at DD, and I was very mm-hmm. Interested in what was going on. And I stayed, besides knowing that it was going on, I saw the very, very, very early test, the mm-hmm. one that was done. And yep. it was really impressive.
He didn't talk or anything though.
No, he didn't talk, didn't do anything. But to be honest, it was all just really impressive what was done. But then I purposefully did not see anything on Buttons. The first time I saw it was the VS screener. And I had no idea how much of it was CG. And mm. I was shocked to see how much of it was CG. It is still in my mind, still one of the gold standards in terms of that level of digital human. I think you and I have had many discussions as to what were some of the advantages it had to being good, in the sense that you don't really know what Brad Pitt looks like when he's old. So that's an advantage to you because you don't have any preconceptions of what he's supposed to be. And there's all these different weird things. But at the same time, it's a very, very, very believable performance in every single aspect of it, from the way that the lighting was done, from the way that the rigging was done, from the character, and just the believability of it. It was really, really good. I think what was also interesting, if you know, that you guys sort of went through the entire process, and then wasn't there like a period of about 2 months where you guys got down to like a skeleton crew and just fixed any little thing that was possible?
Yeah, so that was at the very, very end. You know, he had... David had kind of a, I think we had something like 315 shots or something like that. Yeah. And, you know, we were down to like, you know, 20 shots left to be approved or something like that. Yeah. And so we went down to the skeleton crew and we went and had a screening, or not a screening, but like just a review with David at his office. And it was a very small group. It was myself, Eric Barba, Janelle, Lisa, and Ed Ulbricht, I think, was the only people that went over there.
Right. Okay.
We went in, we sat down, and David went through all of, you know, basically the first 50 minutes of the film with us.
Right.
And we walked away with 120 kickbacks, you know?
Right.
And
it was so like, we basically unfinaled a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's really kind of, if that had not happened, I don't think it would have been as good as it was.
Well, I mean, there's definitely something to be said about the partial success of the whole thing is the fact that it was a David film, right? I mean, you know, the characters... you know, the lighting is already going to be good. The camera, you know, everything about it's going to be very good quality anyway.
Right.
Plus you have a director with a great eye that's giving you feedback on it.
Who understands CG.
Who understands CG. Yeah, right. That's true. And you have Brad Pitt driving it. You know, it's like if we'd screwed that up, you know, badly, like we'd only have ourselves to blame at that point. Right.
Right.
But yeah, there was... I mean, it was a terrifying show. I mean, I remember walking in at the time it was Jeff Stringer's office because, you know, on Orville, there was a lot of people because Orville was done over in the commercial side of the building.
Yep.
And so a lot of the people on the feature side, they were watching, you know, Orville develop or unravel, whichever way you want to picture it. And kind of, you know, we're kind of like the joke, you know, it was like every day they would be watching Orville Dettenbacher Theater or something like that.
Right. And well, that was there was still at the time, and it's not that the case anymore. But I mean, at the time there was an inner rivalry between the commercials.
Oh, there was a huge rivalry
between the commercials and features. Yeah. But so it was a little bit like, the commercial guys are trying to do something, and they're like, so.
Yeah, I had even been called a traitor for going and working in the commercial.
That's kind of ridiculous.
Like, I was like. Yeah. Well, they just moved my desk over there and told me that's my next show. Like, I didn't consciously make a decision to betray anybody.
Right. But. And then when you know, obviously when Buttons happened, it was, you know, the similar crew that was staffed for that. So it was kind of.
Well, we crewed up. So that, and that was why I went to Jeff, because we were trying to staff up for Button.
Right.
And no one wanted to work on the show. Oh, nobody.
Because of Dettenbacher.
Because of Redenbacher. Yeah. Right. Dettenbacher. Yeah. Thank you. And, and so. I went to Jeff and I was like, Jeff, you know, this is probably going to be the hardest thing that we tried to do at DD in terms of just like pulling off some kind of successful trick here.
Yeah.
And nobody is willing to work on the show. There's like three, like Janelle was in, I was in, Eric was in, Lisa was, you know, I was like, that's the only people that were willing to do this.
Right.
And, you know, he said, I talked to, like, I don't know how we're going to do this if we can't staff any of our heavy hitters on this show.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, well, we're just going to have to, you know, hire from the outside. And Eric is just like, if people don't want to be on the show, if they're not dying to be part of this amazing project, like, screw them. We'll find somebody else who is excited about it. And it's like, all right, great. And so, you know, people like Jonathan Litt, you know, we brought in. He wasn't there before that. You know, Matthias had been there, and I'd worked with Matthias all the way back on iRobot and on Flags and a number of other things. And I knew he would be really into it. So we did actually get Matthias on. He was pretty excited about it. And at the same time, you know, there was a project called Rage and Fury, which was going to be bringing Bruce Lee back to life. And so between Orville and Button, there was this project that had come in that we were going to do Bruce Lee. And so we did actually get a little bit more practice. MOVA had basically picked up their process a little bit.
Okay.
And so we brought in the guy that was going to play the body double for Bruce Lee, a guy named Matt King. he came in and we did a full fax session with him in the Mova rig, and we built a Bruce Lee rig.
So almost like Tupac in a sense, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Huh. And so we did some initial testing on that, but I don't know what happened. I heard that the Bruce Lee family was like, nah, we're not really into it anymore. So I don't know what happened, but that project got canned. But it did give us a little bit more practice prior to Button happening. And so I had asked Matthias to help out even during the Bruce Lee thing. And so he was really interested in the whole facial and facts and all that stuff. So he came on to help out. But a lot of the other people that we brought on to Button, we had to hire because no one wanted to touch it.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because after Buttons, it was around the time that I came back to DD. Tron was happening, and I had an interest in going onto that. And it was funny because I'd been sort of known to be doing car commercials at the time. I was like doing lots of car commercials, and then suddenly Eric ends up putting me on the light bike sequence, which is a 9-minute car commercial. So,
yeah.
But you had been working obviously on the Jeff Bridges double. Mm-hmm. So, which I still think there's a lot of really really great things in that. I think it got scrutinized a little bit too much in certain cases, where it's why. If like half a second out of 10 seconds is not quite right, it kind of ruins a little bit of it.
Yeah, you know, the first shot that you see him too was kind of one of our more difficult shots.
Right.
And, you know, it probably didn't turn out as well as some of the others. And so if your initial viewing is that way. I also think, you know, David, on Button, David was very specific about there will be no press about, you know, this thing. Like, he didn't want people to go see his movie to see what a CG head looked like.
Right.
He wanted people to go see Button.
Most people still don't even know it is CG.
Yeah. So it was like no one will talk about, you know, it's kind of like the Fight Club thing.
Right.
Maybe carried over some of that from that movie.
Right.
You know, it was like, don't talk about this. We're not going to talk about it in the press. We're not going to make a big stink about it until the movie's come out, done its thing, run its course, and blah, blah, blah. And then you guys can talk about it.
Sure.
And I think that was really smart because then, you know, people go in just like whatever. And, you know, on Tron, it was a little bit different. It was like this, you know, whoa, we're gonna make sure everybody knows that this is this new technology. And you know, I get it. It's Tron and whatever. But I don't know. In some ways, I think, you know, telling people too much information before they go see a movie is, you know, about how the movie's made. I mean, if you want to show them stuff in a trailer about what the movie's about, you know, that's fine. But to talk too much about what happened on the movie, you know, it's not my job, but I have my opinions about it.
And I think, I mean, part of what I find is, you know, when you're scrutinizing a digital human like you've done for years and looked at it, the problem is that I always sort of equate it as, you know, if we look at a big movie and there's a big, you know, explosion or whatever, and it's poorly comped or not, it's not, you and I are just looking and it's like, oh my God, that's terrible. They did this and this wrong and they would have been better. 99% of the people look at it as like, it looks just fine, right? But when there's something not quite right with digital human, everyone knows that something's wrong, but no one has the answer as to why it's wrong.
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing is, it's even worse than that because, you know, obviously there was a number of people that didn't feel like Tron was successful or whatever. And it's like, you know, I agree with your assessment. You know, I think there's a lot of shots that look pretty good and, you know, there's a couple that aren't as good. And I think that, you know, for whatever reason that cascaded into, you know, the whole thing is bad. But since that point, I was like, well, you know, I was wondering if sort of that difference between where David didn't want people to know ahead of time and, you know, Disney was okay with it, if that would make a difference. And so I'd done some experiments where I'd basically, cause I did a lot of presentations after Button and Tron and so on. And some of these times I would basically show footage of different, like stuff from Button, stuff from Tron or whatever. And then I would show footage of a real person and say that it's CG.
Oh, and people would screw
it. And people tear it apart.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the spec is all wrong. I mean, look at that. You know, look at the eyes. I mean, they look dead, you know, and you're like, okay, you know, so as soon as you tell somebody.
Yes.
Because people don't, I think part of it, I mean, I don't think this is the reason for the Uncanny Valley. I think the Uncanny Valley is a completely genetic thing in us at this point. But, if you tell people, I don't think people like to be fooled in that sense. People like to be fooled in terms of like, I go see a magician and he pulls a rabbit out of a hat or whatever he does. But if you're going to try and fool me into thinking that I'm looking at a non-real person, like regardless of uncanny valley or creepiness in terms of its looks, mm-hmm. there's a creepiness in terms of like, I don't want to be fooled, because that means now maybe, you know, my president didn't say what he really said, or you know, right. like there's all sorts of implications there that you just go like, I'm not okay with this.
Right.
Like subconsciously, consciously, whatever.
Yep.
Somewhere people don't like the idea of buying the fact that that thing isn't real.
Right.
So they'll come up with whatever reason. It doesn't matter. You show them something real and tell them it's fake and they'll tear it apart.
Yep.
Not everybody. I mean, there's people that will go like, wow, that's really impressively done.
Right.
But, you know, there's a number of people that will just go off on it. And then once somebody does, it, you know, it's like lemmings. You know, it's just like, yep. oh, yeah, I see that too and whatever. So so I think it's – there's something about people not wanting to be fooled into thinking a fake human is a real human.
So they just have an automatically defensive reaction to what they're seeing.
I think so. And from what I've seen of just, you know,
yep.
showing people things, it's there's this immediate reaction of just yeah. like, you can't fool me.
Right, right, right.
You know, whereas like you said, with an explosion, I just people think, you know, it'd be like, hey, this explosion is fake. And it'd be like, cool. Like, I don't care.
Yeah, I don't care.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad it's not real because that would have been really bad.
Like, you know, that's a CG dog. Oh, cool. You know, that looks neat. That's a CG human. I know it's bad.
Right.
You
know? Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Like, what happened? Like,
yeah.
everything else was cool until this.
I know. I mean, that's one of the things I always say. Like, when you know, obviously you're part of the Digital Human League, and we're doing this whole Wiki Human project, and I was saying that, you know, when I tell people, it's like, oh yeah, I want to tackle the ideas of digital humans, I want to go through this. And everyone's going, oh, no, that's horrible. It's like, I haven't even done anything yet. And you're already – the reaction is so strong against what a digital human is.
Exactly. And that's why I think it goes beyond even just the uncanny valley.
Right.
Because the uncanny valley is, you know, once you look at something and you have a reaction, right?
Right.
And if it's not real, you have – or doesn't look real enough, you have a reaction.
Right.
But you can just talk about it. And people have a reaction like that. That's
yeah. You haven't even shown them. You haven't even shown them a picture, and so the uncanny valley is there, or maybe not. Like you said, maybe it's not even the uncanny valley. It's just the idea that idea scares people.
And I've actually talked to some people that, you know, they think there's actually multiple uncanny valleys, and that they're there for different reasons.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, there was some kind of psychiatrist or psychologist or something that at the end of Button. I got a call that this guy wanted to do an interview, and I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. The guy comes in. He just finished writing a book basically about, you know, kind of the analyzing people's faces and all this stuff. And,
sure.
And in one of the chapters in his book, he basically said, you know, the human face is so complicated and so we're so sensitive to it and all these things. He said that, you know, making a believable fake human face is decades away.
Right.
And the book was already to be published. It was at the, you know, the publisher or whatever. And he went and saw Button and he called and he's like, you guys don't print my book yet.
You know, really? Like,
yeah. I got to go talk to DD.
Okay.
And so he came in and I had a conversation with him, and there was a lot of interesting stuff, you know, cause everything that we've done is all based on the uncanny valley from the side of, you know, just visual or getting it into a film or whatever, but he's coming at it from a totally different angle. And it was pretty interesting to just have a conversation with him about that. And, you know, and why there is an uncanny valley, if there is, and if there is there more than one, and why there's what each one represents.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's when I have a really deep interest in what we're trying to do with this Wiki Human project, to really sort of explore that, like, let's define what those things are. And because I think a lot of people have tried to tackle it, but it's the immediate emotional response is so strong that there's probably going to be a reason for it, and understanding it, I think it's a really good thing to do. And if we have people that have gone through those hurdles and figured out a bunch of stuff, being it from the acquisition that we get from ICT or whatever, I think those are all really interesting responses. So I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be really cool. But I remember even though I had been very, very close to seeing what was going on with Clue on Tron, I wasn't actually on part of that team. I was working on, you know, the normal car commercial. But I had a huge interest in getting into digital humans at the time. And so, and then I moved on to, I think I was on I was on Real Steel, I think, and then or something. And you approached me as you said you wanted to get him into Digital Humans. I said, yeah, and then I just couldn't do it. Oh no, I remember what I was. I was on 47 Ronin. Mm.
All right.
Yeah, and I said I don't think I can leave the show because they're gonna kill me if I leave the show. But then I suggested Stephen Parker to work with you, and it was really funny because.
Was that on Tupac or was that for Oblivion?
For Tupac. Because what happened is like you said, you know, I just need some really strong person that really knows because we were all V-Ray at the time. Mm-hmm. I was like, we want to get this, you know, going right. And I know you haven't thought about it for a long time. You and I have talked about it and want to get involved. And I said, that sounds great. And they wouldn't let me get on it. And I suggested, like, you know, why don't we get Stephen Parker on there? And everyone's like, he can't do that. He's a TD. He doesn't know anything about lighting. I was like, he's an artist. If you just looked at his resume, you'd realize he's an artist.
It's too bad he's not here.
Yeah, I know. It's too bad he's not here. But he got on to that show. So Tupac was another really interesting thing that you guys did. One of my favorite stories about it, speaking of the scientific acquisition, is the way that you guys turned Snoop Dogg into a 50% gray card.
Yeah.
So tell it, because that's such a great story. First of all, I love the fact that Snoop Dogg was hanging out at DD and he was such a cool guy. But tell him the story about why we needed to use Snoop Dogg as a relative thing.
So, you know, for Tupac, obviously, you know, he passed away quite some time ago. And so all we had to work off of was photos. And, you know, you don't know anything about the lighting. You don't know anything about what film was used or, you know, anything about what his skin tone actually is. All you have is photos. And so sort of the idea that I had was, well, you know, Snoop Dogg is still alive and we have photos of Snoop Dogg next to Tupac.
Tupac,
so
right, that's right.
In theory, if we shoot, you know, Snoop Dogg with a color chart in a known environment, then we can kind of extrapolate.
You can get the relative difference.
Between Snoop and Tupac, and then we'll know, because, you know, we're basing him off of an African American skin, but right. You know,
those very variations, widely, yeah,
like just like any, you know, race or anything. So we really didn't know, and so that we brought him in and put him into our fax booth, and, you know, a nice diffuse environment, and
yep.
Put a checkerboard up next to his head. I'm sure he was just like,
I don't know what's going on.
I don't know what's going on, but what, you know, woohoo,
yeah,
like whatever.
Yeah, it was so – and it was important because he was literally going to be part of the performance as well. So he had to look relatively
– And it was great, the fact that we had Dre and Snoop available to us and Philip and Dylan, who were, you know, directing and producing it.
Right.
That, you know, they all knew Tupac. So it was like, you know, we had people that knew him, met him, you know, had worked with him quite a bit.
Did feel like him and did this act like him.
Yeah, you know, and you have somebody that you can – You know, if all you have, because there was not a lot of video of him singing, you know, he was in a couple movies, very few videos of him singing. And what there was, you know, it's pretty bad quality. I mean, it's back when it was all standard definition and in a club somewhere.
Yeah,
and
some
whatever.
Dingy club is shot on VHS tape or something. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's all the data that we had to work with, and having people come in and that really knew him and knew him really well, you know, worked with him for years.
Yeah.
And we could get an initial reaction or you know, like it could be pretty obvious sometimes. It's like, oh, that's not him.
Yeah.
It's like, why not? It looks like that picture.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where, you know, working from pictures is so tough because, you know, just a simple lighting change on somebody can make their nose look bigger, can make their, you know, their head look longer. I mean, there was that great video that went out, I don't know, it was on Vimeo or YouTube or something, circulated maybe a year ago, where this guy shot video of just lights moving around a girl's head.
Yep. And just changing, like, completely
changes. Yeah, it's like now she's fat, now she's thin, now she's, you know, it's like it completely changes it. And so just looking at photos and trying to, you know, recreate it without any other technical knowledge about what was in that shoot, what lighting the situation was. And
most people who ever see anything about Tupac, be it on the internet, even in a concert, they just see him as a, you know, as a Pepper's ghost, or they see it in a video. But I got to say, cause I saw that head up close and rendered. It was really, really impressive. I mean, I saw what Steven had done with the skin, what the animation was doing. And it just really had a lot of,
it definitely. Yeah. Cause we did all of our reviews, you know, pushed in quite close because we shot it all 4K, even though it was only going to be an HD
right.
projection.
And you did it all at 60 FPS too.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was the longest shot. That was an 18,000 frame shot.
Wow. There you
yeah.
go.
It was, and that was part of the difficulty of it. You know, we kind of looked at it and was like, well, you know, he's bald, so we don't have to worry about hair. And, you know, there's some other, you know, he has a microphone in front of his mouth a lot. So we, you know, that saves us some animation time and everything. So it's like, because we had, I think we had 8 weeks from the day of the shoot to Coachella.
Right.
I think it was 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, so, you lose a week just in them doing their select and ingesting the plates. You know, it's like yep. there's like 14 or 15% or whatever. I don't know. My math isn't working out great, but I know it's more than 10%
right.
of your time is gone, you know?
Right.
And then we had, you know, for animation, we had to process all the facial capture stuff and everything. And so our animators couldn't even start on this until, you know, another week or two, because we had to do tracking and all that stuff. And so, you know, out of that 8 week schedule, we really lost three of it before we could even start animating.
Right.
And so by the time we started rendering, you know, it's like you submit an 18,000 frame shot to the farm and it's like, okay, if anim changed in this one range, great. Right.
Right.
But you also know that lighting is changing, right? Yeah. And if lighting changes, you have to render the whole thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, submitting that to the farm, even DMX, which is our playback system that, we can basically kind of go and look at, you know, the shot at different stages, like whatever artist can shoot things to what we call DMX to look at a playback. Even the process of shooting that shot to DMX was, you know, take hours for it to process.
Yep.
And then deliveries, you know, it was like, all right, yeah, we're going to deliver this one to the client. And, you know, even just getting that onto a drive, you know, and making a quick time out of it, it was just like, oh God, you know.
But I think, you know, it's funny because I think I remember Rito, who had known about obviously this going on because he was working at DD, but he went to Coachella and he didn't say anything, obviously, but people were going to the concert. And I think it was just, you know, everyone's like, I'm just going to a concert and having fun. And then it's the same thing that you said before where they didn't know that it was going to happen. They had no idea. They weren't ready to scrutinize it or be, they just look and it's like, what the hell just happened? I think I just saw Tupac dancing on stage. So it's that same thing. If you take that element away of it, it's a kind of an interesting.
Well, and Dre put on a great show too.
Oh yeah. You
know? So it's like, it was all wrapped into this big thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went to Coachella the first weekend that they showed it. And, you know, I was, Janelle and I had gone, we were standing there just terrified because it hadn't shown yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, you know, is this going to be, I don't know how many people go there, you know, 50,000 people that are just, you know, angry or like, you know, so we're standing way over on the side, like hoping that there's an escape route if there's booing and, you know, tomato throwing or something like that. And so we're standing there watching it and there's two guys behind me. And as the songs are rapping, the guy behind me goes like, that was Tupac. And his friend goes, that can't be Tupac. And he goes, no, that was fucking Tupac. And the guy goes, Tupac's dead. It can't be. So the guy taps me on the shoulder and I turn around and goes, was that Tupac? And I'm just like, this is an awkward, you know, situation. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, that was Tupac. And then right then Dre, you know, says something along the lines of, you know, give it up for, you know, Tupac Shakur or whatever.
Right.
And the guy just shoves his buddy over, like pushes him to the ground. I told you that was fucking Tupac. He's like, that was the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life. And I'm like, hopefully more people felt that way.
Yeah, so,
the whole night was just hitting refresh on the YouTube thing that went out. And it was like seeing how many likes versus dislikes and whatever.
Yeah.
It was a very tense moment.
Yeah. It was really, really huge. I was very excited about it because I thought it was just kind of fun to see that.
Yeah. We were thinking we'd gone to a couple of rehearsals out there and, which was kind of interesting because, you know, you go out to Coachella and there's a giant field and, you know, there's three of us sitting on the field and, you know, Eminem is up there and Dre's up there and, you know, we're the only people in the audience watching Eminem do his concert. It's
like, right.
It's pretty interesting. but, you know, they couldn't rehearse the Tupac thing until nighttime because it doesn't show up on the Pepper's Ghost during the day. And there's a curfew, noise curfew there during rehearsal time before. So you can only make noise until like 9 and the sun goes down like 7. So you have like an hour and a half, you know, 2 hours to actually do anything and talk about it.
Right.
And so the first night that we had brought something out there and they showed it, you know, we're watching Eminem and Dre and, you know, the sun's up and then the sun goes down and all of a sudden you hear the Tupac song start and everyone that was at the rehearsals and everything came out of their trailers and like stood around to watch because they kind of knew what was coming. And, you know, Eminem is standing right there and he's just like, he's just going on about, this is just amazing. And there's some of the girls there that, you know, knew him and whatever, that they're just crying and you're just like, all right, you know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, maybe this is going to work out. So.
And I think it was cool about it, you know, especially it's always very sensitive, right? When you're bringing someone back from the dead or whatever.
Yeah.
And Tupac obviously has this allure to him that's like, did he really die? I don't know. So it's got all of this mystique.
Yeah.
And I think that you know, Dre did a really good job of trying to respect that and making that work. So
yeah, well, you know, it was by the time that we had even started the project, you know, Coachella was sold out. So it's not like, and it wasn't advertised. So it's not like this was a ticket sales gimmick.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they had to get Tupac's mom's permission. And, you know, when she gave permission, you know, Dre donated a bunch of money to the Tupac Foundation or fund or whatever that is. And, you know, I mean, the whole thing was really just to bring him back to people and give a performance. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it's not like they stood to make money from it. And I guess in the end, Coachella got a little more recognition, but they were selling out every year anyway. Like it, you know,
yeah, they didn't. So, and it wasn't, yeah, exactly. You said people weren't going to see Tupac.
So the only money really that came out of it, I guess, is, you know, whatever sales increase that went back to the family, I guess.
And, right.
You know, but it wasn't what that was about. Right.
Right.
And that was what I liked about it. In fact, when we were shooting the Tupac thing, one of the people at DD came down and said, hey, I have this other thing that I want to bid with you. And I was like, okay, what is it? And he goes, well, this guy had bought some, something at an estate auction, that had belonged to Marilyn Monroe. And in the process of going through it, he had found a track that she had recorded for one of her movies that had never been released and wasn't part of the movie. It was like, you know, just a track that she'd recorded, but it had never been used anywhere.
Right.
And so he had bought this trunk with her stuff in it and that was in there.
Okay.
And so he wanted to basically make a music video and bring her back into the music video.
Right.
And my response was, I'm not going to work on that.
Right.
You know, this guy's not Marilyn Monroe's family or like, this is a money thing. Like he found something, he wants to cash in on it and he wants to use her to make money off of. And I said, you know, if DD decides to do it, like, you know, that's... I don't have a problem with that. I said, but I'm not going to be any part of that project. I can't, I'm not going to bring back
a dead
person.
I mean, it is a responsibility. If you know, you've been doing this for a while and you're known for it, but it is kind of a moral responsibility of what you feel like you've got the right to do and what you can make happen. So I mean, you know, Marissa Tang was very similar to Tupac in a way. The family was very, very involved in what was going on with that, which was really cool. And I think that you developed a strong relationship with Dre at the time, and it's just like to make sure you paid respect to that situation.
Yeah.
I think, and I, you know, when I saw one of the another, I forgot who did it, but it was a Bruce Lee commercial.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I just did not feel the same sense of respect because Bruce Lee doesn't even, he's an avid non-drinker. And so why is he selling whiskey, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just not, I just didn't feel that it was the right thing to do. And there is a moral responsibility to digital humans as well. And I think that's something to be considered everything that you're doing, especially when you're trying to bring people back from the dead.
We had a, I won't name the country, but we had a potential client that came from another country that was interested in doing some CG head stuff. And, it was, we were talking about the button stuff and showing the button stuff and, you know, through translation, it was like, oh, so, you know, so Brad Pitt wasn't in the plate anywhere. It's like, no, he wasn't anywhere in the plate. It,
right.
You know, this is all CG. And he goes, could you make Bill Clinton say something he never said? I'm like,
wow.
Yeah. It's like,
yeah.
Yeah, I gotta go to the bathroom or somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
I gotta go. Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, that is a responsibility. Yeah, I mean, you got to think of it. You know, what was the Wag the Dog. What was that movie? Yeah. When they like, you could just totally change politics, change history, totally. Do whatever. And I don't think that is definitely a responsibility.
Well, and I think that's part of what I was saying about when you tell someone that even something real is CG and they pick it apart because they don't want to believe that they can be fooled by that.
Right.
Because that's when those kinds of things come up.
Right.
That's when you can have, you know, like that kind of thing happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think there's some, this is the perfect content for us to add to our wiki page, because I think just the idea of the Uncanny Valley, two, then the reaction that you said, but also the moral responsibility you have. Yeah. Let's say you get really, really good at it.
Yeah.
Suddenly there's a problem there of what you're asked to do.
Yeah. I mean, imagine if Bin Laden was, you know, on TV saying, lay down your arms and give up because we made a digital version of him saying that.
You know?
Like, not that that's a bad thing necessarily, but I mean, there are, you know, from someone's point of view.
Someone else is probably.
So something else similar happened in our situation. Yeah. I mean, it definitely has if things get to that point where it's completely, you know, undetectable and whatever, it certainly has a moral implication to it.
And that's good. Maybe we should lay out a code of conduct for digital humans. That would be good to have. Well, when I asked you obviously to be part of the Digital Human League, and I thought, you know, I was really excited when you wanted to be part of it, because there's while I still feel that I have a good understanding of a lot of the things that I need to do in terms of lighting and those types of things, I think there's still a huge knowledge base that you have in terms of animation and all the challenges involved. But what do you feel you like about being part of this group, and what do you think would be what you like to get out of it in a way?
Well, I mean, I think that the cool thing about it is that it's a, you know, it's almost like an academia kind of thing. You know, it's almost like being part of just a group of people who are interested in talking about this, that there's no necessarily, you know, client that you're trying to please or anything like that. It's just a, you know, like information. It's just exploratory, which is very refreshing in a way that, and in the end, it's only going to be essentially our opinions, right? Because there is no real
metric. I mean, but everyone, a lot of things involve opinions in the
and
everything else. But I think if we get the right group of people involved and there's enough credentials behind those opinions, then they become strong points of view that are important.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But again, there's not a deadline and a director that you're having to please. It's just this is something everyone that's involved in it is involved in it simply because they're interested in it and that it's something that they want to explore. And, you know, it's not necessarily often that you get to group up with a bunch of people like that when there's something like this to discuss. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very interesting thing.
Did you listen to the podcast that I did with Mike Seymour, the FX Guide one?
Yeah.
So I think what I really liked about it, when Mike and I talked about it, we said, he's like, well, it's always fun to get bums on seats, but it's really cool just the idea that we're exploring humanity in a little bit. Anyway, you know, if we recreate a synthetic human, we have to understand ourselves as humans in a lot of way.
Yeah.
And I love that aspect of it. And I love the fact that we have people like Mike and his point of view in terms of what he's going to do, and Angela as well. But
yeah, exactly. People like that are great.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I'd like to get more of that. I mean, I actually have Lucas, who's got a huge interest in looking in eyes and anatomy of eyes, and he's going to work on that. But I also, at the same time, I have a distant relative of mine who's actually had to be a really big expert on eyes. And I'd love to hear his opinion, because he goes on talking about – when I was talking about digital humans to him years ago, he was saying, he's like, oh, well, you know, the human eye moves, you know, 100 times a second or whatever. Yeah. You know, just all these things – about it and going through that process, which is hard for us to do in CG.
Yeah.
So
totally.
So I'm actually interested in, as well as underlying, like, is there a way that we can simulate some of those fine motions or do things of that nature that are interesting? And what are those things? And what are the things that we're supposed to be looking at? Even the, you know, again, Parker's not here, but the idea of the blood flow and how it's not something that we perceive that we are conscious of, but yeah. I think we perceive it.
Yeah, totally.
So I think it's cool. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it.
Sure.
And we'll probably do more. I'm going to have some more guys on the group, but this was really great. I really like some of the stuff you brought up as well. So I appreciate it. So thanks a lot. Awesome.
Thanks for having me on here. Right. I know I've been avoiding it for however long now. So
yeah, but you did. Well, it wasn't so bad, right?
No, except your seats are so fucking uncomfortable.
Really?
No, I'm just kidding. Oh, they're okay. Fine, actually.
Okay.
Good. And the free water.
Free water. Well, normally we have a little mini fridge there, and we can keep beers in there if we wanted to. But
I got to go back to work anyway. So.
All right. Cool. Well, we'll let the last bucket drop.
Do we get to hear the song?
Well, you'll hear it in a podcast. I'm gonna have to put it.
No, I know. But so we don't get to hear it now and kind of
enjoy it.
Yeah.
Well, I can play it for you.
Well, I've heard it.
Okay. Do you like the song, by the way?
It's awesome.